All right, please be seated. Good morning. We have Justice Anne Welsh Bradley, who is appearing by telephone today for these arguments. It's also my understanding that we have East Troy High School here, Walworth County. Could you please stand? Anyone who's here with that group? Wow, great group. It's also my understanding that you won't be staying. You can have a seat if you want. It's also my understanding that you won't be staying for the entirety of today, or that you may have to leave, and at a minimum, you won't be here to discuss this proceedings and how we do things with the justice after this case. So that's okay. It's all good. It's just nice to have you here today, so we warmly welcome you to the Wisconsin Supreme Court. The first case we have today is State versus Cesar Antonio Lira. Counsel, it's my understanding that you will be arguing 25 minutes, 30 minutes, and then a remaining 5 minutes, right? So your light will come on and when you'll still have some time in your initial arguments, but you'll have your 5 minutes reserved for rebuttal, and that'll be in addition to the lights that come on, just so you know. Could you state your appearances, please, for the record? Excellent. Nice to see you this morning. Welcome to the court, and please proceed.
Good morning, Chief Justice, Justices. May it please the court. While this case has a long history, it has a common theme: Mr. Lira's efforts to avoid serving a lawful Wisconsin sentence. In 2004, Lira escaped jail custody to avoid revocation and imposition of a 16-year Wisconsin prison sentence. As an escapee, he fled to another state and committed new, very serious crimes and was convicted and sentenced. Now he seeks credit for those out-of-state sentences against the very sentence he escaped custody to avoid serving in the first place. To grant sentence credit in this situation both seems wrong and is wrong under any reasonable reading of Section 973.15 sub 5 and under any reasonable application of this statute to Lira's case. There are two reasons that credit is unavailable under this statute. First, the statute's plain language provides that an offender lawfully made available to another jurisdiction is entitled to credit for custody in that jurisdiction, quote, under the terms of Section 973.155. But Brown, the case on which the Court of Appeals relied in awarding Lira credit, held just the opposite. The courts may not consider the terms of 973.155 when 973.15 sub 5 applies.
Counsel, do we need to overrule Brown in order to find in your favor?
No, I don't think that you do need to overrule Brown, but I believe that it's likely the court took the case in order to construe the statute for the first time, and the state believes that Brown's reading of the statute is unreasonable because it doesn't give full effect. But you could distinguish this case on its facts from Brown. In Brown, the person was sentenced and was made available to the other jurisdiction before being transported to the prison, and so they didn't have an opportunity to start serving their prison sentence. And I believe that those facts are what drove the erroneous interpretation of 973.15.5 in Brown. It's a classic example of difficult facts making bad law. The court could have easily construed the Brown situation narrowly and said that in a situation in which a person is has been revoked and sentenced but is awaiting transfer to the facility to begin serving their sentence, because under the statutes a person doesn't begin serving their sentence until they've actually set foot in the prison, then it could have drawn it narrowly and said that in this situation a person is entitled to credit. We'll constructively view it as being begun at this time. Instead, it said we just don't consider 973.155 at all, and that's contrary to the language of the statute.
Do we need to do that, counsel, though, if we determine that you need to look at the terms of 973.155? Would we need to carve out that exception, or wouldn't that fall within the reading of the statute that takes us to 973.155? Do you understand what I'm asking? Would the situation in Brown be covered if we – would that person get credit if we read it the way you're asking us to read it?
Without language saying that they should be entitled to credit under those circumstances, I don't think that they would get credit because the interpretation that we're advocating here is that if the provisions of 973.155 apply, and that means that Boettcher's interpretation of that statute that says dual credit is not permitted, then the person would have to actually be serving the sentence to be entitled to credit, because in the Brown case, the person was provided to the feds without being sent to the Wisconsin prison first. So their sentence didn't begin. So their sentences didn't run concurrently. So I think if you wanted to make sure that the situation in Brown was taken care of, you could say, well, Brown could have easily been decided this way instead, and provided that it was constructively begun when the sentence was imposed, but the person wasn't actually transferred to the prison.
Otherwise, would that person get no credit for the time that they were actually awaiting, actually setting foot into the prison?
That's correct, yeah. The person would then be entitled to no credit because under 975.5, it says that credit is available when a person is provided to the other jurisdiction. And under the state's interpretation, which incorporates 973.155, sorry, these statutes are all so similar, and I know it's frustrating, but because it includes the sentence credit statute, maybe that's easier to refer to it that way. It depends on the person actually starting the sentence in order for it credit to begin. I think that serves a really important purpose. It ensures that a person who is a convicted offender but is not on supervision or not on probation or on some other status in which they're not actually confined doesn't receive credit under this statute. I think stepping back from the statute, looking at its language, I think that the legislature likely intended — this is a little dangerous because we're not dealing with plain language here, which is what I'm arguing in our briefs — but I think that the legislature likely intended that a person who is confined and then provided to the other jurisdiction, that their sentence will continue to run. Because under this, the language of the statute, it says that someone is provided to another jurisdiction under Chapter 976 or in any other lawful manner shall be credited with service of his or her Wisconsin sentence or commitment and under the terms of 973.155. Where does this sentence come from that they're talking about here? I think it has to be a sentence that's actually being served at that time. I don't think that it can be a sentence that was previously served or that's in anticipation of being served. Otherwise, we have a situation where a person could try to claim credit after serving time in another jurisdiction, coming to this jurisdiction, and then claiming it against a prospective sentence, or in this case, against a sentence that has not yet begun to run because the person escaped, committed new crimes. The other reason that I think that the state's interpretation of the statute makes sense has to do with the particular facts of this case here. And the made available phrase. Apart from Brown's misreading of 973.155, Lira can't claim credit under this statute because he was not Wisconsin's offender to, quote, be made available to Oklahoma in May 2006. At the time, he was an Oklahoma prisoner, and even while he was in Wisconsin, he was serving an Oklahoma sentence because he was here under the IED, under the Interstate Agreement on Detainer.
Do we know that? Your brief seemed to just hedge a little bit on that.
I have to hedge. Yeah, I didn't just cross yet.
Yeah. So the way I'm reading what you've submitted to us is, because of the Interstate Detainer Act, you believe that he received that credit in Oklahoma, but there's no judgment of conviction or some other paperwork from Oklahoma that would indicate that he, in fact, did. Is that fair?
Yeah, and that fact, I think, relates primarily to just the 4.5 months of credit that are for his time here in Wisconsin, 2005 and 2006. That's why I say that if you don't feel comfortable saying that he wasn't a detainer, I assume you can ask counsel today if that was the fact, and take his response if it is, in fact, a confession and rely on that. But if he doesn't concede that point, then it might be worth sending this back to the circuit court to find those particular facts. I assume that that's just the way that people are made available to other states is under, and Oklahoma is a signatory to the Interstate Agreement on Detainers, and I assume, but I don't know for certain, that that was how he was provided here to Wisconsin. And but assuming that that is how he was provided here, his sentence continued to run while he was here. He continued to be an Oklahoma prisoner. And so he wasn't really Wisconsin's prisoner to be made available to another jurisdiction, which is another reason why it's inappropriate to provide credit under this statute.
So I'm not sure what Mr. August is going to do, but if I were going to bet, I'm going to guess he's probably not going to concede that point. If he doesn't, then are you suggesting, asking us, or you agree that we should then remand this to the circuit court so that they can then figure out whether or not he got credit in Oklahoma for those 4.5 months?
I think it might be appropriate only as to the question of whether credit's available on the 4.5 months when he was here in 2005 and 2006. Because I don't think that it matters with regard to the other.
So the dates then that we are talking about for the 4.5 months would be from?
So he's returned, presumably on a detainer, to Wisconsin to face new Wisconsin charges, both endangering safety and escape at that point. And then
That was in May of 2005?
That's right, May of 2005. And then when he's here, the authorities in Milwaukee County accidentally release him. And just to be clear, why that's wrong to release him is because he's an Oklahoma prisoner at the time.
Right. Yeah. No, there are probably 100 reasons. I mean, that is it's a mystifying fact in this case. But right.
Yeah.
So he's able to post bail in June. So
yes.
They're asking for credit for that month from May, either 19th or 22nd, depending on how you figure out the transport,
right,
until June 15th, and then he is he absconds until December 13th, 2005, right? When he's arrested.
That's right.
Texas.
That's right. Yeah. And that, so he's captured in Texas, and then he's returned to Wisconsin, where he finally faces those charges, and then he's returned to Wisconsin in early 2007. In terms of, there are some disputes, I guess, were some disputes in the Court of Appeals about specific dates. That might be another for remand, you know, providing sort of guidance to the court to determine precise amount of credit, if any credit is due. Now, I don't necessarily think that credit will be due in this case, but if credit does end up being due, it might be appropriate to sort out factual disputes in the circuit court.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. And none of that's in the record, right? We can't look at the record to figure any of that out?
Oh, I wish we could. Yeah,
okay.
But
we,
it's not there. So I think one of the issues that the court has to address here in determining the meaning of under the terms of Section 973.155 is the scope of that provision. That's one of the issues that's in dispute here. I think that at the very least it must include any so-called procedural requirements, such as the bar on dual credit for anything but concurrent sentences. If that's not adopted, then this would be a new class of credit for which that rule didn't apply, and I don't think that makes a whole lot of sense. And that the application of that particular rule also requires then that the person be serving the sentence, which, as I've already explained, has positive influence on how the statute is executed, because I don't think that we want people who are technically convicted offenders but aren't actually confined being provided to another jurisdiction and then asking for credit for that time in the other jurisdiction on a separately served sentence. You know, it could be something that maybe in Martinez, for example, what happened there was the person was they were sent to another jurisdiction, they returned, and then they reoffended. They were revoked and sought credit for that time that they were in the other jurisdiction. Now, under just the plain language of that statute, they argued, or rather under Brown's interpretation of that statute, I shouldn't say the plain language, but under Brown's interpretation, all that was required was the person prove that they were a convicted offender and they were made available to the other jurisdiction. Well, that would technically include anyone that's on probation or on supervision. So I think that it makes sense that the person actually be serving a sentence in order to receive credit under the statute. Be serving a Wisconsin sentence when they're made available to. And when I say sentence, what I mean is they actually be confined, so that they actually be imprisoned at the time. In terms of whether 1A applies, there are arguments against applying 1A in this instance. You'll notice that the language of the statute provides that a convicted offender who is made available to another jurisdiction under Chapter 976 or in any other lawful manner shall be credited with service of his Wisconsin sentence under the terms of 973-155. There's a longstanding provision, as we've discussed here in my briefs, of the IED that allows for credit to continue when a person is provided to the receiving jurisdiction. So person is made available to the receiving jurisdiction, the sentence continues. There is no requirement under the IED that that custody in the other jurisdiction be in connection with the course of conduct for which sentence is imposed. I think I don't want to sort of play devil's advocate here with my own argument here. I'm sort of undermining it just a little bit, but in preparing for argument here, I think that the court should be aware that there might potentially be a reason not to apply Section 1A, even though it is a term of 973-155, and it's the most prominent term. It's the first term in the statute, which is why in briefs I argued that it did apply. But I don't think that the court, I don't think that it would necessarily be wise to interpret the statute in a way that would modify the interstate agreement on detainers, because that's a contract, that's an agreement that the state enters into with other states. And if we were to interpret that in a way that narrows the availability of credit or says that the only situation in which a sentence will continue to resume is if the person is if the custody in the other jurisdiction is connected to the course of conduct for which the Wisconsin sentence is imposed, then I think that might be an interpretation that would be problematic. So the state's position here, though, is that all of the other requirements of 973-155 should apply, and including the requirement in Boettcher, which, given its longstanding nature, is essentially a term of the statute, and I think that it makes sense to include it here.
Counsel?
Justice?
What other ramifications or potential ramifications exist if we were to agree with your statutory argument and overrule Brown? Specifically, how would it affect those who are currently serving a sentence who've received sentence credit consistent with the Brown interpretation of the statute?
Oh, that is a good question. I am not certain of the answer to that question. I certainly could address it in supplemental in a letter to the court if you would like. I'm not certain how this court has handled new interpretations of the sentence credit statute that whether they've had retroactive application or not, whether they've required. Now, I think that it's unlikely that a person who's received credit under this statute, under the Brown reading, would then be denied it. That seems like there would be due process issues with that. To be honest, I don't have an answer off the top of my head to that question.
That might be an issue for another case on another day.
It might potentially, yeah. But thank you, Justice Bradley. I think the interpretation of the statute that we have here provides a windfall for defendants in Mr. Lira's situation. Now, it is an unusual situation, but let's suppose that he committed his offenses. Let's suppose that the facts are all the same in this case, that he escaped custody in Milwaukee County, but instead of going to Oklahoma, he went to Taylor County, and he committed his new offenses there. Now, we have something called the Interstate Agreement on Detainers, Intrastate Agreement on Detainers, that works basically in similar ways to the interstate agreement, in that credit is when a person is lawfully provided to the other jurisdiction, to a county from a state prison, then the sentence continues. But my point here is that the only reason that Mr. Lear is entitled to credit under this statute is that he happened to escape to Oklahoma. And the Court of Appeals found that because he was provided then in some fashion, not actually made available, but just returned under the Interstate Agreement on Detainers, he's entitled to credit. But if this situation happened in Wisconsin, I don't think that the person would be entitled to credit. So it creates a windfall for people in his situation. Also, just wanted to emphasize again the facts of the case. You couldn't come up with more dramatic facts to illustrate the how Brown's interpretation of the statute leads to unfair results. I see that my yellow light is on. Are there more questions from the court? Seeing none, I would just ask the court to reverse the Court of Appeals decision, overturn Brown, and apply an interpretation of 973.15.5 that gives effect to the phrase under the terms of 973.155 and conclude that Mr. Lear is not entitled to credit. And I reserve my remaining 5 minutes. Thank you.
All right, counsel.
Good morning, and may it please the court. My name is Christopher August. I represent Mr. Lira, who's also here in the hearing room with us today. I admit that I am a little puzzled as to where to start my argument today. The state petitioned this court for a specific reason. The state petitioned this court asking this court to overrule Brown. Today, the state has indicated that Brown should not be overruled, but in the same breath seems to say
counsel, I don't think that's what opposing counsel said. He was asked by the Chief Justice, do we have to overrule Brown to decide in your favor? And he said no. So he really wasn't asking us to do it. He was saying that we didn't have to do it and we could still come out on his side. But I didn't take his response or the Chief Justice's question the way you have.
I also think it's notable that the state perhaps maybe has not conceded that issue, but for the first time the state has now indicated that 1A of the statute, the sentence credit statute, 973.155, does not apply. Whereas its consistent argument in the Court of Appeals and in the briefs are that 1A does apply. So now we are left in a situation where instead of addressing that component of the statute, the state is now selected to say, well, no, that's not incorporated into the statute. Instead, the state has superimposed some new requirements on the statute that the offender be confined, a term that is not reflected in the plain text of that statute. I think there's two things that I want to make very clear. I think, number one, the law in Wisconsin is clear. Brown is the law of Wisconsin, and I would direct this court to the Wenke versus Gell case that I discussed in my briefs. And that case tells us that when we have a published Court of Appeals decision, that's entitled to stare decisis, and that it's not sufficient for the state to point out that a published Court of Appeals decision is mistaken. The state needs to go above and beyond that. It needs to show that that decision is, quote, objectively wrong. And we see in the Gell case the way that Justice Prosser arrived at the conclusion that I think it was the Leverenz case was, quote, objectively wrong. It was a very searching inquiry. That's not what I see the state doing in this case. And presumes and seems to ask this court to determine the meaning of these statutes as if the court is writing on a blank slate, when that is not the case.
Counsel, can I ask, before you get into anything further, one sticking point for me that I need some clarification from you is the language in connection with the course of conduct in 973-155-1A. How are the sentences in Oklahoma and Texas and Wisconsin all in connection with such that a person deserves credit for time in custody?
So I think two things. I think, number one, one answer to that would be, and I think this is the answer that we see in the jury instructions, the special materials that the committee chooses, which is that the statute itself creates the connection. Certainly we're dealing with here, the connection requirement is a statutory requirement. The legislature is free to, I think, modify that requirement as it sees fit. I think another alternative,
let me just make sure I've got that right. You're saying because 973.15 references 973.155, that's the connection?
So certainly that the legislature could, by the terms of 973.15.5, which are very plain, which indicate that if the preconditions are met, a person is a convicted offender, and they are then lawfully transported, that they are entitled to credit for the duration of the time in the other jurisdiction. I think
so. The in connection with doesn't mean the facts or the two charges relate to each other. The in connection with means anytime you're arrested and transferred, you're automatically in connection with and get credit?
So my argument is that one could reconcile those two statutes by utilizing the answer that is present in the special materials to the jury instructions, which talk about the legislature creating a connection if those requirements are satisfied. But I would also point out that the state has now conceded today that 1A does not have to apply in this circumstance. And that has been my argument consistently in this case, that by honoring the plain language of 15.5, in order to harmonize these statutes, we need to give effect to the special role of 15.5. And the only way we can do that is by allowing the offender to obtain credit in that other jurisdiction, because if we were to strictly apply that in connection requirement, it's possible that you would never be able to earn credit under 15.5. If the court is going to say 1A kind of trumps the language of 15.5, that your custody has to be in connection, I think, Chief Justice, you're onto something correct, which is, okay, how is your connection, for example, or your custody if you're transported to Chicago, you're staying in the Cook County Jail for 6 months, how is that ever going to be, quote unquote, in connection? So we have to acknowledge that either 15.5 is modifying or 15.5 is doing something different. I don't think that there's a way for us to say, and I think that's why the state has now made the concession, that 1A does not strictly apply, and the position that they took previously in their briefs was that we have to strictly apply that section of the statute. I think it's clear that that produces these results where either 970.315.5.
It almost sounds like you're saying anytime you commit a crime anywhere, you get credit for all of them. They cannot be consecutive to each other. You get, well, they could potentially, but you get credit in all of them for all time served anywhere.
What I am saying is that if a person satisfies the requirements set forth in the plain language of the statute set forth by the legislature, which is that they are a convicted offender, and Wisconsin then lawfully transports them to another jurisdiction, that they are entitled to credit for the duration of time spent in that jurisdiction.
Even if the two crimes have absolutely nothing in common?
Yes.
Okay. All right.
Because as I set forth in the briefs, I think the only way to harmonize these two statutes to make sure that 973.15.5 is playing a role is for us to view the cross-reference to the sentence credit statute. And it's important. The legislature said section 973.155. The legislature cross-referenced the entire sentence credit section. So in harmonizing these two statutes, we have to find a way for both statutes to coexist alongside of one another without one statute swallowing the other or contradicting the other.
If I don't buy your argument, can you still win?
If you don't buy the argument that...
That you always get credit even if a crime is completely separate and distinct. If I don't buy your argument about 155 meaning, forget that it says in connection with the course of conduct, they just mean you get credit. Sentence credit. You get sentence credit any time you are transferred to another jurisdiction.
My position is that you get credit if you satisfy the requirements of 973.15.5.
You're made available to another jurisdiction. You get credit. So anytime you're transferred to another jurisdiction, you get credit here too.
Correct.
Okay.
You would continue, your sentence continues to constructively run in that other jurisdiction. I think maybe thinking of it as credit might be the wrong foot forward. Thinking of it as the statute allows the Wisconsin sentence to continually or constructively run might be the better way to look at it.
Wouldn't that make every sentence concurrent with the out-of-state sentence? So you'd only be serving a period of time for two different crimes when no judge has ordered that those two sentences be concurrent?
So I think the statute is very clear. The statute indicates that the Wisconsin sentence continues to run while you get credit for the duration of the time in the other jurisdiction. Now, certainly, I think in an ideal world, what would happen is that the offender would return to Wisconsin. But that's not what happened in this case. In this case, Mr. Lira remained in the other jurisdiction for over a decade before
Let's just say you commit an offense in Florida in whenever, 99, and you're found in Wisconsin because you've committed another offense here in 2009, and you're Florida, somehow you got out of Florida and came to Wisconsin, didn't serve that sentence. Florida has a warrant out for you. Florida wants you back. So I'm a trial court judge in Wisconsin. I am hearing the case on the new charges 10 years later, completely different state, completely different victims, completely different offense. Florida says, we still want this person back. They need to be serving our sentence. The judge in Wisconsin must give credit for any time served in Florida. Is that what you're saying?
So I think in your...
If the person's transferred back.
So in your hypothetical, the person has not yet been convicted in Wisconsin, or they...
whatever your preference is. Let's say they're convicted and there's a sentence waiting for them. Let's say they've got 10 years in Florida and 10 years in Wisconsin. And the 10 years in Wisconsin is consecutive to the 10 years in Florida. So they haven't served a day in Florida yet. They're transferred back in Florida to start the 10 years. You're saying that the Wisconsin sentence is zero. They really don't even have to come back because they get credit for every one of the 10 days they serve in Florida.
So if the person is a convicted offender, they've already been convicted, and Wisconsin then transports them to another jurisdiction, they would continue to accrue credit against their Wisconsin sentence for the duration of the time in that other jurisdiction. I think it would be an unusual situation in which Wisconsin, where an offender was actually serving a sentence at, say, Dodge Correctional, and we made the decision to send them to Florida to, quote-unquote, serve a sentence.
So is that the ticket? It's not just the sentencing? I always thought you got sentence credit even if you deserved it. It came when you're going to serve the sentence, even if you haven't started a day. Usually at sentencing, the judge says, and you deserve 364 days credit toward the sentence. And then they're whisked off to prison. So is it the service that starts it?
Well, so I think that's what makes this statute unique, and it's different than the usual credit cases that we see, where usually what we're dealing with in these cases are those pre-conviction credit cases. This is a post-conviction credit statute. By the terms of the statute, which references being a convicted offender, it's talking about credit that you would necessarily have applied to your case after you've already been convicted. So it would be a situation where the trial court wouldn't necessarily be in the position to make that.
Sometimes they come back before you because people disagree with DOC's determination of what's due, right?
Right, and that's my perspective on what the cross-reference enables us to do, is that 973.15.5 is a substantive rule that entitles offenders to earn credit against their Wisconsin sentences. And by cross-referencing the sentence credit statute, again, a statute which was created at the same time, a statute that we know based on this court's decision in Boettcher was created with the purpose of creating this mechanism for offenders to have credit applied to their sentences, the cross-reference merely enables that substantive credit rule to be effectuated. Under sub 3, it tells the DOC how to apply and compute that credit. Under sub 5, it tells the offender that they can file a motion in circuit court, as Mr. Lira did, or they can petition the DOC, also as Mr. Lira did. And it tells the offender that if they don't get their credit under 973.15.5, their remedy is an 80930 direct appeal. It answers all of those questions. And so that's the way in which we can harmonize these two statutes. Because again, I think when we're harmonizing statutes, we choose that analogy of harmonization very deliberately. I think it would be a mistake to think of these statutes as two puzzle pieces that we, you know, pick out of the box and we should expect them to snap seamlessly together. I think State versus Mason, the Court of Appeals case that I cite in the brief, and also this court's decision in Matasik, talk more about this idea of best fit, of harmonization. We're talking about both statutes are sounding different notes. It's the goal to harmonize them, to find a way for them to work together without one statute being swallowed or rendered inoperable by the other.
Why,
Mr.
One final one.
Please.
Why, thanks, Justice Krofsky. Why do you think the legislature chose the words in sub 5 under the terms of? Do you think the terms of 973.155 mean anything, or why did they even use that language if you just get credit?
So I think that they, as I set forth in the brief, I think the best reading of the under the terms language, given the other language in the statute, especially the language that you get credit for the duration of the time spent in the other jurisdiction, is a way of effectuating that rule. Under the terms, directs the person in the 973.15.5 situation, do you think you're entitled to this credit? Were you transported somewhere else? Your remedy is to then pursue that credit by filing a motion in circuit court, filing a motion, captioning it a 973.155 motion for custody credit, and it would pursue down that procedural path that we're all familiar with dealing with in the circuit courts. And if you don't get the credit, you can pursue an 80930 direct appeal. If the legislature does not use that cross-reference to effectuate the rule, then the statute's effectively orphaned. There's no way to effectuate it. I think the alternative to that, and the alternative that the state proposes, renders the statutes unworkable. It's not harmonization, because instead what we have ending up happening is we have either the entirety of 973.15.5 is rendered surplusage. Because if all we're going to say is that you have to satisfy the normal credit rules and you have to go file a motion under 973.155 and that's all you have to do is satisfy that statute and those rules, what work does 973.15.5 do? It does nothing. And so while the Mason case talks about, the State versus Mason, the Court of Appeals case, says, you know, the preference against surplusage is not absolute. It's okay. And I think even the states conceded in their interpretation that we don't have to incorporate 1A. It's okay if not every part of the statute is being incorporated, but we have to try as best we can to find the best fit between these statutes. The other problem that I pointed out previously is that 973.15.5 becomes inoperable. That if we're going to strictly apply the reading that the Chief Justice put forth, it becomes difficult to effectuate 973.15.5. And then the final problem that we run into, and I think the state has consistently run into in this case, is struggling to articulate a situation in which 973.15.5 under their reading does apply. In the briefs, the state uses, I think, this incredibly problematic example that you have to be convicted in Wisconsin, you have to be transported to another jurisdiction, then your time in the other jurisdiction has to be factually connected, then you have to receive a concurrent sentence in that jurisdiction, and under those circumstances, you get the credit.
Does the cross-reference that you refer to in sub 5 to 973.155 have any relevance to the words of 973.155.1, days spent in custody in connection with the course of conduct? Does that have any relevance? So if there are two different courses of conduct, how does that fit?
So I'd note, number one, the state has already conceded that...
But you know what? The state doesn't get to decide the case. We do. Okay, I'm really interested in your answer, which is why I asked the question.
Certainly. So I don't think that if we look and we apply 973.15.5, I don't think that the connection with the course of conduct rule would apply. Because again, as I argued in the briefs, that would render 973.15.5 problematic to ever actually implement.
Well, it depends on the way you look at it timing-wise. I understand that. But your answer to me is simply it doesn't apply in this case.
That's correct, unless the court was to accept the kind of reading, the more expansive reading that the committee chose in the special materials, so the jury instructions, which indicate that 973.15.5 creates a connection. I think that would be another way, if the court is troubled by, that fit and the court is interested in that, that's an alternative that the jury instruction committee has already set forth in the special materials that's out there. That's an answer.
So, Mr. August, if I'm understanding what you're saying, if Mr. Lira had been sentenced in Oklahoma to 20 years and had not been brought back to Wisconsin, but had served the 20 years, and then he was sentenced here 20 years later after he served his sentence, obviously he wouldn't get any credit, correct?
That's right.
So, but the problem I'm seeing then is that those cases the Wisconsin cases, wouldn't reach a resolution for 20 years. He wouldn't know how they were going to resolve. The victims in the cases wouldn't know how they were going to resolve. The witnesses. I don't understand how that would work under the way you are looking at these statutes. Cases would just be hanging out there for years and years and years.
So I think that's an argument. I think they made that in the reply brief. And I'm not... sitting here taking the position that the answer, the solution, the way out of this is for no state to ever turn over anyone to any other state, and that somebody has to stay in a state and serve the entirety of their sentence there before they can come to Wisconsin. That's not at all what I'm setting forth. Under the plain terms of the statute's just clear that your sentence continues to constructively run if you're made available. And I think that there's an incentive for states to return people to the other places where they're supposed to go. I don't think that there's any, it doesn't follow that just because your sentence is constructively running, that the only way to avoid this is nobody gets transferred anywhere. Because we already have, you know, for example, under the IAD, we already have this rule about temporary custody, and we have an assumption under the statute, under the IAD, for example, a similar statute, that offenders should be returned to their sending state, and that we should be facilitating exchange, but people don't stay where they are for 20 years until a sentence is completed. That's why Mr. Lira's case is unique, and I understand why the state wants to emphasize the specific facts of this case. But again, that situation is, I think, incredibly unique, the fact that he stayed in Oklahoma for as long as he stayed there. I don't think that's going to be every case in which 973.15.5 is invoked.
Counsel, can you, with your opposing counsel, there was discussion about the 4.5-month time period and whether there was credit in Oklahoma. Could you please address that?
So Mr. Lira had a revocation order and warrant that was already on file. That was filed in 2004. If I'm getting the date wrong, I apologize. But the revocation order and warrant commanded that Mr. Lira be returned to Dodge to begin serving his revocation sentences. Under the statutes and the case law cited in the brief, the offender continues to accrue sentence against the revocation until they're actually sent to Dodge to begin the prison term. In other words, the state can't artificially delay a person serving their revocation sentence. If you sit at, say, the county jail for a year and a half, your revocation sentence doesn't start when they finally send you to Dodge. It starts once you're actually formally revoked. And so under those authorities, that's why I've asked for the credit for Mr. Lira for those 4.5 months. So that would be the situation there. Now,
you're not paying, it doesn't matter to you, or as far as your argument is concerned, that he may have gotten credit for that 4.5 months in Oklahoma. You're saying whether or not he got credit in Oklahoma, he should still get credit in his sentences in Wisconsin, against his sentences in Wisconsin.
It might have an influence for the purpose of that analysis. Again, it shouldn't matter for the 973.15 analysis, but if we're talking about this kind of more straightforward credit, that second issue is, I think, a more straightforward credit more frequently in this court, that potentially would have an impact. However, as the state's indicated, we don't have an answer in the record as to whether he received that credit, as to how he was transported here, et cetera. And I note that, you know, the state represented that this was the vehicle to overrule Brown. We're here ostensibly to determine those issues of law. I hear the state today indicating that there's deficiencies, there's gaps in the record, there's problems with the record, and that's why ultimately this case should come down to factual determinations potentially to be made by this court or to be remanded to the circuit court for further proceedings. You know, I understand that perspective, but I think it's problematic given that the state has petitioned this court specifically for the purpose of resolving these questions.
Counsel, just so I can make sure I get to the bottom of it, so if we did agree with the state's argument on Brown and overrule it, would you agree that remand is the appropriate thing to do with regard to the Oklahoma credit?
So I think the Court of Appeals already ordered a remand with respect to the days of credit to be apportioned across the sentences. I think ultimately a remand would not be inappropriate in terms of determining credit. I'm just merely pointing out that in terms of petitioning this court with respect to the issues, if this is going to become a factual dependent case about disputed issues and gaps in the record, I think that that's fair to point out. But no, I don't think a remand would be inappropriate, and I think the court has remanded in similar circumstances.
Well, what would we do instead? Would not be inappropriate. Could you be a little more firm for me? Do you think that's what we ought to do, or do you think that we should do something else?
I think if this court finds itself reviewing a record and getting bogged down in factual questions that are not resolvable by the record, and the state's position is shifting as to what the court should do based on how it petitioned the court and the issues it presented the court, I don't want to tell the court that a petition was improvidently granted, but it certainly seems to me like the case is trending in that direction. Again, by petitioning this court and asking the court to overrule precedent, to change the law in Wisconsin, because again, keeping in mind that under the law that exists right now, Mr. Lira succeeds. The only way for the state to succeed is for this court to change the law. If we're going to be talking about changing the law, I'm not sure that it's appropriate to be having that discussion if instead we're going to get in a protracted conversation about days of credit, where people were when, how they got here, what credit they got in Oklahoma, et cetera.
Is there any plausible connection between the Wisconsin and Oklahoma courses of conduct, the offenses? I mean, the actual offenses that occurred, aren't they quite separate and distinct?
They are. So the sentences at issue in this case are revocation sentences for drug conduct from 1992 and 1999, so 30-year-old drug conduct, and conduct in the 2000s when Mr. Lira fled and during the course of fleeing had an accident and someone was tragically killed. So I would concede that his decision to sell drugs in 1992 is not factually connected to his fleeing in Oklahoma 30 years later.
How do you
What about the Texas offenses? Is there any plausible connection between Texas and Wisconsin offenses, factually, charges and factually?
So I'm not aware of any charges that arose out of Texas. I do know that Mr. Lira was charged with a bail jumping in a separate Wisconsin case, because when he was erroneously released on bail when he should not have been, he missed a court date. He didn't attend a court date. A condition of his bond was that he attend all court dates, and so the state of Wisconsin charged him with a misdemeanor charge of bail jumping. And so, again, I don't think a misdemeanor charge of bail jumping under those circumstances would be factually connected to his drug dealing in 1992.
How do you reconcile your reading of the statute with the Boettcher case? Because the Boettcher case stands for the proposition that you do not give credit against two different sentences that are concurrent only if those sentences are consecutive, right?
Right.
So how does you reconcile that with giving the same credit for the Oklahoma sentence as would be given in Wisconsin, and would we address that Boettcher case somehow?
So in Boettcher, this court was interpreting 155 and read into 155 based on a persuasive reading of the federal authorities this dual credit rule. The court was not addressing the specific language of 15.5, which uses the very plain, very direct language of that the offender shall receive credit for the duration of their custody in the other jurisdiction. And I think that that's very precise phrasing, and that I think does create an exception to the Boettcher rule, that if you satisfy the conditions of 973.15.5, your sentence is going to continue to run while you are in the other jurisdiction.
I think I said cases and I meant custody, Texas. Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you, counsel.
Just to return to your question, Justice Dallet, I do think that it's likely that the dispositive question here is whether Boettcher does apply, because it is a term of 973.155. I mean, it's so foundational to this court's understanding and the Wisconsin court's understanding of that statute to be a term of 973.155. So, and given that, I believe that the sentences have to be concurrent. That means that, you know, opposing counsel was talking about being provided to the other jurisdiction. to continue to serve the sentence. Well, the implication is, of course, the sentence is running. And here that wasn't the case. But if a sentence is running, then the two are concurrent. Here the two were served separately, and he wants them to be, quote, constructively, I guess, deemed to be running, which is sort of an undercurrent argument that's in his briefs but isn't actually fully developed. So I just want to be clear. This court did not improvidently grant this case. Brown should be overruled. It's objectively wrong.
How do you address opposing counsel's argument that your reading renders 973.15 sub 5 inoperable? But there's nothing left of it if you read it the
sure,
way
that you... Sure, sure. Yeah, when I was preparing briefs in this case, I wasn't persuaded by that argument because the fact that it has a narrow applicability doesn't really tell us much about what the legislature intended. The legislature could have intended for it to have narrow application. And just looking at it that way, I thought that sub 1A did apply. Stepping back a little bit and looking at the language of the statute many, many more times after that, the problem that I have with applying 1A right now is that the statute applies to Chapter 976, which is the Interstate Agreement on Detainers. And there's a provision in the IAD that allows a sentence in the sentence in the sending state to continue to run. And I don't think that this court would want to adopt an interpretation of 973.15.5 that would affect the provisions of the Interstate Agreement on Detainers. That's a contract among among the states, and I don't think that it can modify that. And by concluding that 1A does apply in this case, it would mean that the only time that someone would get credit or the only time that a sentence would continue to run under, and let me provide you with the exact statutory site here, it's 976.055 sub F, which provides during the continuance of temporary custody or while the prisoner is otherwise being made available for trial as required in this agreement, time being served on the sentence shall continue to run. And so if 1A applies to this, then arguably the only time that the sentence would continue to run is if the custody in that jurisdiction were in connection with the course of conduct for which the person was sentenced in Wisconsin. That's the problem with applying 1A. I don't like to undermine the arguments that are in my brief, but I think that I have a duty to do so if I think that it would result in an interpretation that that is problematic or unreasonable. And so I believe that every other part of 973.155 does apply, but I don't believe that 1A should apply in this case because of that problem that we would run into with the Interstate Agreement on Detainers.
So I want to make sure I'm following you. So if you're saying 1A doesn't apply, then are you telling us that we shouldn't concern ourselves with the phrase in connection with the course of conduct?
Yes, I am saying that. I'm saying that the portions of the statute that apply are all but that portion. So that means that Boettcher applies. Boettcher's understanding that the statutes must be must run concurrently in order for dual credit to apply applies in this case. And every other section and the cases that are well established that interpret the statute should apply as well.
Counsel, I'm a little unclear what to do at this point with that information. Obviously, I've not.
Sure.
In depth, but it seems to undermine the theory of your case.
I don't think, respectfully.
Please go ahead and tell me why not.
Respectfully, I don't think that it does. I am, in a sense, conceding that 973.155 does not, all of it does not apply, that in fact the one part that doesn't apply is 1A. And the reason, again, for that is because it would result in an unreasonable change to the Interstate Agreement on Detainers. Again, I
Why is it an unreasonable change? I'm just not following.
Okay. I'm not following that either, frankly.
Okay. I'm sorry.
No, if you can explain it, I would really like to understand what you're saying.
Okay.
All
right.
And your time is running out. However, you left considerable time on the clock in the beginning. So I'm going to allow you to answer that.
Okay. Let's take a look at the statute again. It's 973.15 sub.
Right.
A convicted offender is made available to another jurisdiction under the Interstate Agreement on Detainers, which is a part of 976. So under the IAD or any other portion of 976, or in any other lawful manner, shall be credited with service of his or her Wisconsin sentence or commitment under the terms of 973.155.
And all that's pre-conviction.
The sentence credit statute does deal primarily with pre-conviction. But under the terms of 973.155, then would appear to modify not just in any other lawful manner, but also Chapter 976. And that would include providing the person to the other jurisdiction to stand trial on new charges. And so that would suggest that if 1A applied, that it would mean the credit is only available when the sentence is when the custody in the other jurisdiction is in connection with the course of conduct for which sentence is imposed. Am I helping?
976.05 sub 5, is that the section that's
yep.
troubling you? Okay, well, I think we'll need to noodle and do a little more research on that.
Okay.
After the argument, but thank you for pointing it out.
Sure. And if the court has further questions after conference and would like additional briefing on the question, I'd be happy to provide that too. But as I was saying, every other provision of the statute, 973.155, does apply, including Betcher's interpretation of the statute.
So thank you, Commissioner.
Respectfully, I ask the court to reverse.
All right. Very good arguments today. Turns along the way. We appreciate being here. The East High School students, I think, are going to head out now for the remainder of their tour, but we are happy that you joined us here. Okay, have a good one.